You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Milwaukee is the new home of the records of a group of religious sisters who have been working to bring education to communities around America since 1847. We talked to the archivist about the long-running history of the School Sisters of Notre Dame. First, between now and the August 14th primary, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested primaries for statewide offices and congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and The Morning Show. You'll be able to find all of those interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Today, we start with the Democratic candidates for lieutenant governor. The winner of that primary will face the incumbent, Rebecca Clayfish, in November. Mandela Barnes is a former Democratic state representative who currently works for State Innovation Exchange, a national progressive group that makes model legislation for state-level politicians. He joins us now from our studios in Milwaukee. Mandela Barnes, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me this afternoon. Really appreciate the time.
Well, what role do you see for an effective lieutenant governor of Wisconsin?
So right now, I see this as a role. I want to be very active in the legislative process. You talked a little bit about the employer State Innovation Exchange, where we provide research and policy support to progressive state legislators across the country. As a former legislator, I still have some passion for a lot of passion, I should say, for legislative work. And we know that, the executive branch and the legislative branch should always work together as they should. So I want to, be able to facilitate a lot of those conversations. I want to be able to provide some sort of shuttle diplomacy between the governor's office and legislative leaders, because we have to act if in the event that we are elected, and we have to provide a big, bold vision. We have to have a big, bold agenda, a plan to restore opportunity across the state of Wisconsin.
Are there particular issues you'd want to champion as lieutenant governor?
Well, absolutely. I've built my campaign around the essentials of opportunity, and that means equity in health care. It means education access, environmental protection, and improving our economy. Four issue areas where this state has struggled relative to our Midwest neighbors and also relative to the rest of the United States. Our middle class is falling quicker than most other states in the country. We're dead last in new business startup growth, and income inequality is at its highest point since the Great Depression.
How do you see your background? You touched on this a bit. How do you see your background as a former lawmaker and now someone involved in progressive policy being a benefit to your role as lieutenant governor if you should win?
Well, relationships matter, and I've maintained my relationships in the legislature. I've been endorsed by nearly 30 out of the 50 Democrats in the legislature. I think our last count had us at 29. And also, I have relationships with Republicans. When I announced my campaign for lieutenant governor, Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinke was one of the first people to text me.
Do you think you could build on those relationships with Republicans to reach across the aisle? I mean, one possible outcome is you end up with a Democratic governor, but one or both chambers in Republican control. Could you bring parties together there?
So actually, that's not an outcome here in Wisconsin. After the primary, the candidates for each party for governor and lieutenant governor actually run in tandem. You run paired.
I'm saying it could be Democratic governor and lieutenant governor, but Republicans could control a chamber of the legislature.
Sorry about that. In the event that that does happen, I think it's important for a lot of outside organizing to happen, because if Governor Scott Walker goes down this November, that is a signal that the people of Wisconsin have had enough with the direction of this state, and the only reason that majorities will be kept in the legislature if that happens is because of gerrymandering. And that's when we organize outside of the building. That's when, we go into districts and talk about the need to expand health care, the need to expand the minimum wage, the need to create living wage jobs across Wisconsin. So it becomes a different strategy in the event that there is still a chamber of the legislature controlled by Republicans.
Now, if you win your primary, you would be on the ballot with TBD. We don't know who. One of eight possible candidates. How do you see yourself working with the still-to-be-determined candidate for governor?
Well, the first thing we have to do is win. Even if there are differences with whoever that candidate is, I would rather argue those differences in the majority. I would rather argue those differences from a place of power. So from August 15th through November 6th, we have one common goal in mind, and that is to win. And after we win, we need to be effective, and we'll figure out the differences, if there are any, once we get to that point.
Talking to Mandela Barnes, one of the candidates for lieutenant governor in the Democratic primary, Election Day coming up on August 14th. Now, some of those Democratic candidates for governor have said that they would do their best to cancel out the Foxconn incentive package. Nobody is completely on board with the package as written, it seems like. Would you support that effort to cancel the Foxconn deal?
So the Foxconn deal is very flawed. I'm against the state of Wisconsin as a taxpayer. I'm against being taken advantage of. I'm also against the environmental degradation. That is a real problem. And those are things that have to be talked about. Those are things that need to be worked out. I'm also on the board of a group called Midwest Environmental Advocates, and we recently filed the lawsuit to challenge the water diversion. So there are some necessary steps that need to be taken to make Foxconn a more equitable project if it is to stay in Wisconsin. And I do think that we have been dealt a bad deal. However, if we are stuck with it, we have to do the best that we can with the project to ensure that actual living wage jobs are being created, but also making sure that our environment is protected. There's also air quality issues that could arise as a result of Foxconn and their air emissions contributing to smog in the region.
Now, Governor Walker can point to very low unemployment numbers in the state, large numbers of people employed, looks like pretty good economic prospects in the state. How do you argue against that being on the rival ticket?
Well, the problem is living wage jobs haven't been created. We have people who are working full time who are living in poverty. And if you look at the poverty rate in this state at 12%, I mean, 2 years ago, poverty was at its highest point since 1984. So people are working much more for much less in this state, and that's no way to have a solid, sustainable economy. So it's not working for too many people. Too many people still struggle to get ahead, and that's because corporations have written the rules for a very long time. They've been able to get away with whatever they wanted to. On January 1st of this year, 18 different states raised their minimum wage. Wisconsin was not one of those states.
Let's bring on a caller. Mary is with us in Brookfield. Mary, hi.
Hi, how are you? Hi, Mandela. How you doing?
Hey, I'm fantastic. And you, Mary?
Good. Thank you. I'm on your side. I want you to know that before I present my question. But my question is this. Do you feel that you have enough experience to serve as lieutenant governor? And I'm just asking. Thank you.
Mandela?
Oh, absolutely. I'm the most experienced person in the Democratic primary for lieutenant governor. I've actually served in government. You know, you can't run government like a business. And you know that if you've served, and having been in the legislature for two terms and now working for a policy organization, I think that this position is actually right up my alley.
And can you tell us, thanks for that call, Mary, can you tell us who or what inspired you to pursue a career in public service?
Yeah, I mean, so after college, I finished school in 2008, and that was just an exciting time. You know, Barack Obama was on his way to being the Democratic nominee for president, and that was a very inspiring thing for me. And I said, well, you know what? I at least want to try this out. I'm going to be fresh out of college. And I ended up working as a field organizer in Louisiana during the 2008 election. And that's where it all started. I came back to Milwaukee in 2009. I actually did an unpaid internship in Mayor Barrett's office and ran for state representative in 2012 at the age of 25 successfully. And here I am today as a 31-year-old candidate for lieutenant governor.
We'll leave it there for now. Mandela Barnes, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Mandela Barnes, former state representative and Democratic candidate running for lieutenant governor. Businessperson Kurt Kober will join us at this time tomorrow to talk about his campaign in that primary. Between now and the August 14th primary, WPR has invited candidates who are running in these contested primaries to join us for interviews on Central Time and the morning show. You can find all of those interviews as they happen at wisconsinvote.org. In 1847, Sister Caroline immigrated to the United States at the age of 23. A year later, she was put in charge of the School Sisters of Notre Dame in North America. Later known as Mother Caroline, she was the sister in charge of building a mother house in Milwaukee and eventually created a network of over 200 convents, 2,000 sisters, and 70,000 students. The records of more than 9,000 nuns who have served in North America are now all in one place. The new North American Archive opened this year at Mount Mary University in Milwaukee and serves to document the lives and missions of the sisters. Michelle Lewandowski is the archivist of the School Sisters of Notre Dame North American Archives, located at Mount Mary University. Michelle, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, these records have been out there. They've been around for a while. What's significant about this new archive now in Milwaukee?
Well, the archive used to be broken up amongst eight provinces. They've merged now into two. And each province had its own archives, and they were located throughout the United States and Canada, and all of those collections have been brought to Mount Mary under one roof. So the entire collection for all of the school sisters in Notre Dame and North America are now under one roof. We have a nice heat and humidity controlled room. We've got a fire suppression system, so they're very well protected and are available for people to use.
A lot of people in Wisconsin and elsewhere were probably educated by School Sisters of Notre Dame. Can you tell us a little bit about their history educating people around North America?
Yeah, so the congregation was founded in Bavaria in 1833, and in 1847, as you mentioned, Mother Teresa, who founded the congregation, and Mother Caroline and a few other sisters came to North America, and they originally started a mission in Pennsylvania and then sort of started some schools in Baltimore. And in 1850, Mother Caroline came to Milwaukee with four other sisters at the invite of Bishop Henney, and they took over Old St. Mary's School in Milwaukee. And so they started kind of building from there. Milwaukee became the first province for the school sisters, and they grew, and by 1968, the Milwaukee province, which included Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio, had more than 1,700 sisters, 144 schools, and they were educating over 59,000 children. So they grew pretty rapidly and expanded throughout North America, but they were initially based in Milwaukee.
And talk about the mission of the school sisters. Why was this organization of nuns so committed to education?
So they were founded to educate German girls in Germany, obviously, and then they were originally brought here under the support of the King Louis Mission Society, who wanted to educate German immigrant children. And so the sisters were invited to come to North America specifically to educate German immigrant girls. And then eventually they expanded and also taught younger boys. Usually the older boys were taught by somebody else, but they would teach the younger boys and the girls in the German parish schools.
Now take us into the archives. What are some of the stories that they can tell?
They tell so many great stories. So the history of the archives goes back to 1847. But just to tell you a few things that happened in Wisconsin, one story I particularly like is in Appleton. The parish's Sacred Heart Society would convert the first floor of the school every Sunday into a complete bar saloon. And every day or every Monday before classes, the sisters would have to go in and clean up the rooms and put everything back in order. And as you can imagine, they didn't love this. And so they complained, and eventually an old building was converted to a parish hall so that the saloon could be kept there and the school could be kept just for the students.
Wow.
Yeah. And then, you know, some other stories, too, are very personal. In 1858, Mother Caroline, who was in charge of the sisters in Milwaukee, traveled to New Orleans with a priest from the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, Father Anton Urbanek. And on the way back, they were on a steamship called the Pennsylvania. And halfway through their journey, the ship exploded. The steamer blew up. Father Urbanek was killed. Mother Caroline was sort of running around the ship trying to figure out how to get off. And an African-American man working on the ship gave her a life preserver and told her how to get to the lifeboat. And so she actually survived. But more than half of the people on the ship died, including the priest that was traveling with her.
I want to bring in a caller. We've got Clarence with us in Watertown. Clarence, hi.
Good afternoon. Yes, I am 70 years old. I was taught for 10 years by the School Sisters of Notre Dame in Sun Prairie. All six of my siblings have gone through that school in Sun Prairie. And my late mother was taught there 12 years, all by the School Sisters of Notre Dame. And I have the utmost respect and admiration for the nuns and the order that they kept in the classroom.
Clarence, thanks for that call. Michelle, I bet you hear a lot of stories like that. Now, if someone like Clarence, who'd had this in their family, wanted to learn more, do they have access to the archive, and can they look up maybe some of the nuns who taught them?
Absolutely. One of the biggest requests we get is from former students who want to know more about their teachers. And so they can, if you go to our website, there's contact information. You can call me. And a lot of people are afraid to call because they only know her name, you know, her religious name, and they don't know a last name. That's okay. I can figure out who they are for you. And I can send you biographical materials, obituaries, photos if we have them, so that you can learn a little bit more about the sisters that taught you and had an impact on your life.
Clarence, thanks for that call. Milwaukee reporter, I think it was Jim Stengel, wrote about the archive, and he had been taught by some of these sisters and looked them up himself. And he wrote that, you know, this, it made them come to life as people, not just as the nuns who taught them. Is that an experience you hear a lot?
I do. And I, you know, I really love hearing from former students because a lot of them will tell me great stories of how these sisters impacted their lives, you know, maybe set them on a different direction in life, you know, maybe gave them an ear when they didn't feel they had one otherwise. And so they really appreciate getting to actually learn about the sisters as women and educators and learn more about what they did, because these women have led really incredible lives, many of them. And so they often find out little tidbits of things that they didn't know about that they kind of enjoy hearing.
And Michelle, we think of archives as being things of the past, but is this a living archive? Are you still collecting new material?
Absolutely. The sisters are still alive and well and doing really incredible things throughout the United States and Canada. And so as things happen, we are still collecting materials from the two existing provinces that'll kind of slowly trickle in as things happen. But yeah, absolutely, this is not a stagnant archive. We are constantly collecting new materials.
Are there materials that you know are probably out there somewhere and you'd really love to bring into the archive?
Yeah, you know, a lot of the stuff that we have from the schools where the sisters taught, we have very limited records. Usually what we have are the chronicles that the sisters wrote that kind of talk about major events at the schools. But we don't have other materials from the schools, like photos. Photos are a huge thing, especially because before the 1950s or 60s, the sisters weren't allowed to have their photos taken once they took vows. So we have very few photos from before the 1960s.
So if somebody's listening and has an old photo from their days at a school sister's school, you'd be interested?
Absolutely. We would love it. You know, like commencement programs. You know, anything that kind of gives a little bit more information about the school itself is great to have because we don't always have those materials.
Michelle, thanks a lot for telling us about this.
Absolutely.
Michelle Lewandowski is the archivist of the School Sisters of Notre Dame North American Archives, located at Mount Mary University in Milwaukee. The combined collection just opened earlier this year. Now, when you read a news story about a thorny political topic, say gun control or abortion or the conflict between Israel and Palestine, you might be familiar with the form that story is going to take, the details, some of the facts, and quotes from people on either side of the issue. Our next guest says that formula isn't good enough and that it may actually make political polarization worse. She says that by understanding the psychology between conflicts of opinion and by embracing the messiness of disagreement, the media can start helping people to see across the divides. Amanda Ripley is a journalist and author of two books, including The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. Her recent piece for the Solutions Journalism Network is called Complicating the Narratives. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, a really interesting thing about your piece is you looked at media coverage of divisive issues and you looked for ideas and inspiration outside of the world of journalism. Talk to some of the people you went to figure out how to talk and how to get people talking about divisive issues.
Yeah, and I'm just going to admit straight up that I didn't think I had that much to learn about this. I mean, I thought, you know, I've been for 20 years interviewing people and dealing with conflict and building rapport with sources, and I was wrong. So I spent about 3 months with people who deal with conflict in different ways, conflict mediators, psychologists, lawyers, rabbis, ministers, all kinds of people who actually are trying to find ways to make conflict healthy and productive and are used to dealing with all the weird and unproductive things that humans do when they're in really intense conflicts. So it was fascinating and probably the most kind of professional growth I've experienced in a long time.
So coming out of that, tell us some of the things that you think we in the media, include us here too, get wrong or oversimplify in non-productive ways when we talk about conflict.
Well, it turns out that when you give people two sides of an issue, which is what we're sort of trained to do, give people both sides, that actually leaves the reader or the audience more entrenched in their pre-existing biases. So particularly when something's really controversial and people have a sort of very, you know, passionate, entrenched views about it, it needs to be a more complicated narrative. It needs to be not just one side and then the other side, but, you know, on the one hand, on the other hand, on the third hand, right? Like going back to the beginning and then taking you down one road and then going to a cul-de-sac and coming back. And that doesn't mean that it's a mess, right? It doesn't mean that it doesn't make sense at the end, but it just means that it's a little more nuanced than just pro and con. And I think that's something that's pretty basic to journalism that none of us really appreciate.
And you write that sometimes that means stepping beyond the simple answer. Do you like or dislike the president, or do you support or oppose gun control, things like that, and exploring with people the motivations, the stories that led them to the way they think now?
Yeah, and really the main reason to do this, the most kind of self-serving reason, is because it makes the story more interesting. You know, I mean, it just makes it fresher. Somebody explained it to me this way, a woman who works in mediation with custody and divorce cases and also bigger international conflicts. She said, you know, it's like with a couple. When a couple's first dating, their arguments are kind of complicated. Like, it takes a while to get to the main issue. By the time they've been married for 20 years, you know, they can tell you exactly what's wrong with the other person in like 30 seconds, right? So there's some truth in that 20-year marriage narrative. But you also flatten out a lot, right? Like, you lose a lot and you make a lot of very quick cascading assumptions. So the same is true when you ask someone about Trump or you ask someone about, immigration. Like, it flattens out the narrative if you just ask it head on the same way it's been asked a million times. But there are questions that mediators suggested asking, like, you know, what is oversimplified about this issue? You know, what do you think the other side wants? What's the question nobody's asking? Those are questions that most journalists don't think to ask, but I think would lead to more interesting content.
I think sometimes we want the quote that really sums up one side of the argument and then the other side. I don't see journalists and editors prioritizing the people who say, I have mixed feelings about this. And we lose we lose a whole center ground on a lot of stories, it seems like.
Right. It is easier to do with more space and time. I mean, I think that's probably right. But I don't think it's as hard to do as we assume, if that makes sense. I think you can, you know, one woman who was a journalist for a long time before she became a mediator, she said to me, if I could go back to being a journalist, I would spend less time trying to be clever and more time trying to include the pieces that didn't fit, you know, the things that didn't quite fit the narrative that I would just normally just cut and ignore, trying to think about, are there ways to let readers and audiences experience ambiguity and uncertainty? I think there are, and we all have experienced that with really great storytelling, but, you know, it's the kind of thing that she just didn't realize how valuable that is until she switched to dealing with conflict in another way.
Talking to journalist Amanda Ripley about her piece called Complicating the Narrative, saying the media needs to do a better job writing about issues where there's a lot of conflict. Amanda, I could see a journalist or an editor looking at this and saying, well, hold on, it's not my job to facilitate productive conversations. It's my job to report on what's happening and give, in broad strokes, a variety of perspectives to the reader. They can then take that wherever they want.
Right. And I definitely felt that way, too, before I started working on this. You know, it is absolutely not journalists' job to make people get along or feel better or anything like that. You know, that is I totally agree. But there's a great quote by Jay Rosen, who's written a lot about the media for many years. He said, you know, the purpose of journalism is to see the public into fuller existence. You know, and we can talk about what that may or may not mean, but it's hard to argue that we're succeeding right now. You know, not only do we have a discourse that's degraded and honestly kind of boring at this point because it's so predictable, but we also have the lowest level of trust from the American public ever. You know, since I got into this business, it's gone down significantly, the percentage of Americans who say they trust major news outlets. So we've kind of need to do something differently if we're going to be relevant.
How would you put this into practice, and how are you going to try to put this into practice as a journalist? You're writing about whatever polarizing issue. What do you do differently, say, in a print piece?
Well, one thing is to kind of ask different questions when you're doing the interview, like those questions I mentioned earlier that kind of get beyond the talking points and more to the personal. But another thing you can do, and this I've started doing all the time, not just in my work, but in my personal life, when someone is passionate about something, angry or distressed or whatever, you need to understand that they need to feel heard before they will listen to you. So if you're interviewing someone, that means that you take what they said that seems most important to them, not to you, but to them, and you distill it. You give it back to them in the best language, best way you can articulate it. And that doesn't mean you agree with them. It doesn't even mean you validate them. It means you're saying, what I hear you saying is this. And you really have to listen in order to do that. And what you find is a surprising amount of the time, having tried this now, people will say, actually, that's not quite right. It's actually this, a slightly different nuance. And that's partly because we overestimate our ability to understand each other, but also because words are imperfect, particularly when it comes to really, you know, passionate, hot button issues. And so you find that you get to better clarity, right? And more interesting nuance when you do this, when you distill things back to people. And just as importantly, they suddenly become open to other information. Like they will become more curious right in front of your eyes. Like they will listen to information they didn't want to hear 15 minutes before. When they feel heard, they will listen. And that's kind of like a human algorithm that is just non-negotiable. And, you know, I don't think it's one that we all appreciate enough.
At a fundamental level, you write that maybe people in journalism and other fields, too, have a basic bad assumption that we as humans make these really rational decisions. We go out, we seek facts, and then form our viewpoint based on that. And that's really not how it works.
Yeah, and I hadn't really thought about this before. I mean, for years, I've been writing about, you know, behavior and behavioral economics and other things like that. And I knew that, you know, for decades, economists, for example, had assumed that humans were reasonable actors operating in a rational world. And then they realized, you know, starting in the 70s, psychologists proved over and over again that they were wrong. Economists were wrong. So eventually they very reluctantly adjusted their models to take into account predictable human errors and biases and real behavior. And journalists have never done that. You know, like we've never actually adapted our assumptions for what we know about human behavior, particularly when people are, you know, polarized and suspicious.
We're talking to journalist and author Amanda Ripley about what the media can do to cover polarizing issues with more nuance, more complexity, in ways that maybe foster better conversations among people who disagree. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about what she's been covering and writing about? And what do you think journalists and journalism should be doing differently when it comes to covering some of our most divisive political topics? Do you look at a story on TV, in the newspaper, online, and think that really oversimplified it? Or they're not getting my perspective. I don't see myself reflected in what's out there in the media. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. On the other hand, is there somebody who you think is getting it right, is doing the kind of thing she's talking about? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with journalist and author Amanda Ripley about how the media can cover polarizing issues and bring out different points of view and nuance. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think journalists could do better when talking about the topics that tend to divide people? If you feel like you've lost trust in the news media or a substantial portion of it, what would have to happen for that to change? How do you talk with people you disagree with in your daily life? Is it possible to disagree agreeably? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Amanda, I wanted to dig into one of the experiences you had at Columbia University, the Difficult Conversations Laboratory. Can you talk about that and your experience there?
Yeah, this is an incredible place. It is literally what it says it is. It's a place where they actually intentionally create the kinds of conversations that most of us spend all of Thanksgiving trying to avoid. And so they, for 10 years, have been bringing strangers together. They pair them up based on their viewpoints on polarizing issues. So they take people who are opposites on something like abortion or gun control or the Middle East, and then they have them talk for 20 minutes. They record the conversation, and then they analyze it afterwards to see, you know, what is different from each conversation to the next. Like, why do some of these conversations go really terribly and have to be like shut down before the time is officially up? And why do some conversations go so much better?
And what makes those better conversations go well? Have they figured that out?
Yeah, actually, more than I would have expected. So it turns out they can actually induce better conversations.
Cool.
They find if they give people something to read before they meet, before their difficult conversation, right before, that's about a different polarizing issue. And they give them a version of information, like an article, say a news article, that is complicated, that isn't just one side and the other side, but leads you down one road and then back and then down a little cul-de-sac and really tries to get at the many, many different points of view on a complicated issue, like, say, the Second Amendment. And if they give another group of people a much simpler version of the same article that has all the same information, but is really more like a traditional news story where you get one side and the other side, what they find is that people who get that traditional news story tend to get mired in negative conversations. Like they just kind of shut down, the complexity collapses in their conversation. They don't ask questions of each other. Whereas the people who got the more complicated article tend to have a healthier conversation. Not to say they agree, like they never agree and no one wants them to. It's more like they ask each other questions and they hear each other and they treat each other like humans longer than the people who got the simple news story.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Justice is on the line in Waukesha. Justice, hi.
Hi, how are we doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Justice?
You kind of hit on it a little bit. I was going to speak upon the content. You know, I equate it to, you know, watching the news on Channel 4 about a subject or 6 or 12 or local news. You know, it's all the same news. And then watching the same subject matter on Frontline, 2-hour special that talks specifically about that topic. It has, you know, I guess how content impacts the polarizing issues in the media, like how much content can you get from a unilateral source, you know, TV, radio, newspaper publications. They're all kind of like there's no opportunity for conversation. It's sort of just one-sided and unilateral.
Justice, thanks a lot. There's a lot we could dig into there. Let's start with, you know, the shorter form, that piece you might see on TV versus a 2-hour Frontline special. I think there's a fear in the media that, hey, the people out there have a short attention span. We don't have time to dig into this kind of nuance and have people still watch, Amanda.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the biggest obstacle, and I'm glad that Justice brought up TV news because that's still where most people get most of their news is TV news. It's not from social media. It's not from magazines. And so this is really important. And the excuse journalists usually raise is, hey, we don't have time. You know, we're in this really competitive market. We have to hit people with something shocking really fast or else we lose them. And I think that's true. But I think there are smarter ways to be shocking, just to put it very bluntly. One way you can shock people is by telling them something that's true, but that runs counter to their assumptions about a simple issue, an issue they think is simple that is not simple, right? So we know that if, for example, there was a nice column that a colleague of mine just did, Perry Bacon Jr., and he wrote about how Republicans see and make assumptions about Democrats that are repeatedly untrue and vice versa. And they did this big survey and they could see that like people make all these assumptions about each other that just aren't true. For example, Democrats consistently overestimate how much money Republicans make by a lot. And Republicans consistently tend to overestimate the percentage of Democrats who are African American by a lot. So there are these like warping tendencies that we all have, and pointing that out to people is kind of a counterintuitive headline that can get our attention without just, you know, fueling the animosity.
And Justice also mentioned being frustrated with what he termed as unilateral storytelling. So I read, you know, the paper writes the thing and I read it. Are there ways to, I don't know if crowdsource is the right word, but to bring the audience into the equation? I mean, that's what people hoped that online forums under news stories were going to be. That didn't work out so well. But are there good ways to bring the voice of the audience into the journalistic production?
Yeah, I think he's 100% right. Like, why is this still a one-way street? I mean, yeah, now we can do comments and social media, but let's be honest, like most of that just degrades the conversation. I don't think in most cases, journalists still have not really handed over meaningful control to their audiences. But there are small examples of news outlets trying to do this, trying to regain trust by giving trust, which is the best and oldest way to rebuild trust with someone is to trust them yourself first. So let me give you an example. There's an outlet called Harkin Media that helps newsrooms solicit story ideas from the public, from their readership, ask them, what should we work on next? And then once they get a list of, say, five different ideas, they have them vote on it, right? So it's not that the journalists are irrelevant. I mean, they're still, reporters are still making decisions about how to do that and still writing or crafting the final segment, but they're asking the public for their input and responding to that. And that's how you build a relationship, right? Like, you listen to each other. You don't just talk.
Talking to Amanda Ripley, journalist, she says journalists, the media should do, can do a better job in talking about covering polarized issues. Back to your calls now. Todd is with us in Green Bay. Todd, hi.
Good afternoon. Yeah, there's several things. I think the media is actually kind of fomenting a lot of the polarization that goes on. And the way that that happens is that news stories are reported with a lot of little editorial content inserted into a story so that it makes it not just a true news story, but it's got a definite slant to it. And it's just oftentimes the insertion of a certain word or a phrase, a little qualifier here and there, and that's one thing that happens. The other thing is there's a lot of omission that is going on. So, and I find that one of your callers earlier said that the news is all the same no matter what channel you flip to, and he's right. You can watch ABC, NBC, CBS, MSNBC, CNN, and they're all going to be reporting the same story. They are also going to omit the same stories. So you wind up getting a one-sided approach, one side to everything.
Todd, thanks a lot for the call. I want to bring Amanda in on that. What do you think?
I think that's a good point. I mean, I think people tend to fall onto patterns that are easy and known and established, and we all do this in every profession. And I think, you know, the good news is it's not working anymore. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the media is desperate for a new business model, and the latest trend is to try to go to more of a subscriber model, which may or may not work. It has its pros and cons. But when you do that, it means that you have to have really a more of a long-term relationship with your viewers, with your audience. You have to, if you're asking them to pay you, then, you know, you want them to come back day after day. It can't just be a sensational headline about tweets or cats. It has to be something that really engages them and that is about what they are thinking about. I mean, I think, you know, Todd's right. When you read something and you can see the little biases creep in, the little assumptions, the little sidebars that, you know, maybe the journalist thinks they're being clever or maybe they don't even know they're doing, it really distances you. I mean, it just really is discouraging, and you don't feel like you're being heard. And that goes back to this basic human algorithm, is we won't open ourselves up to new ideas until we feel heard.
We'll leave it there, Amanda, but I think we'll probably ask you to talk about these issues more in the future. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Amanda Ripley is a journalist and author. Her recent piece for the Solutions Journalism Network is called Complicating the Narratives. She looks at how the media can do a better job of covering some of our most polarizing issues and help people understand the other side, even if they don't ultimately agree with the other side.